Blog Talk Radio.
Saturday morning, and this is the Cosmic Citizen on Blog Talk Radio. My name is Paula Thompson, and with me are my dear friends and hosts, Andre Redatis and Crystalline Beek Larson. Good morning, friends.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So good that you're here this morning. I so look forward to Saturday morning spending it with you. And also with us again, I'm so pleased to say, is Charles Lawrence Olivier and Neil Waldrop. Welcome, dear friends. I'm so glad you could join us again. And Neil, we're looking so forward to another week of the unceasing campaign of the Master Seraphim.
Thank you very much, Paula. It is a tremendous pleasure and also a privilege to be here. I will share with you a slight difficulty I have. You say good morning, and for me in the Eastern time zone, it's really good afternoon, but anyway, whatever.
Good afternoon.
Good.
Good day.
I'm right there with you, Neil. We're in afternoon land here.
Yes, we are.
And good afternoon to anyone else out there, and good evening even to some who are listening from the UK and maybe other places like that. So good day to all. We are continuing on with the unceasing campaign of the Master Seraphim, and we've been having a great study session, I think, in-depth study of the work of the Master Seraphim, and Neil has been taking us through a fantastic study guide that he created, and very thought-provoking questions throughout. So, Neil, maybe you can tell our listeners where they can find that, and I will also post it on the board.
Thank you very much, Paula. As Paula has stated, we are continuing our discussion of a study guide on the work of the Master Seraphim that I prepared with the assistance of various volunteers in the Committee for the Global Endeavor. The study guide is composed of 14 pages. We are at about the halfway point, effectively at the beginning of page 8. I recommend for any listener who has not already downloaded it that you proceed to do so, because you will find it much easier to follow our discussion if you have the study guide available to read along with us. Here is the website link that you can use to find the study guide, www.globalendeavor.net. One word, GLOBALENDEAVOR.net. And the link for the study guide is toward the bottom of the homepage. You will find it very easily. Now, as in previous weeks, we are going to begin today by reading Section 6 of Paper 114 out loud. And while we are doing that, those of you who need to download the study guide will have, I think, sufficient time to go ahead. So now, for the first section, I should say the first portion of Section 6 of Paper 114, I need a volunteer. Who would like to volunteer to read that material?
I'd be happy to.
Okay, fine. So please read from the beginning of the section through paragraph bearing the number 4, which concerns the angels of nation life. Thank you.
Okay. This is Section 6 of Paper 114, The Master Seraphim of Planetary Supervision. When the first Governor General arrived on Urantia, concurrent with the outpouring of the Spirit of Truth, he was accompanied by 12 corps of special seraphim, Seraphington graduates, who were immediately assigned to certain special planetary services. These exalted angels are known as the Master Seraphim of Planetary Supervision, and are, aside from the over-control of the planetary Most High Observer, under the immediate direction of the resident Governor General. These 12 groups of angels, while functioning under the general supervision of the resident Governor General, are immediately directed by the Seraphic Council of 12, the acting chiefs of each group. This council also serves as volunteer cabinet of the resident Governor General. As planetary chief of Seraphim, I preside over this council of seraphic chiefs, and I am a volunteer supernaphim of the primary order, serving on Urantia as the successor of the one-time chief of angelic hosts of the planet who defaulted at the time of the Caligastia succession. The 12 groups of Master Seraphim of Planetary Supervision are functional on Urantia as follows. You want me to read then through number 4?
Yes, please.
Number 1, the Epical Angels. These are the angels of the current age, the dispensational group. These celestial ministers are entrusted with the oversight and direction of the affairs of each generation as they are designed to fit into the mosaic of the age in which they occur. The present corps of epical angels serving on Urantia is the third group assigned to the planet during the current dispensation. 2, the Progress Angels. These seraphim are entrusted with the task of initiating the evolutionary process of the successive social ages. They foster the development of the inherent progressive trend of evolutionary creatures. They labor incessantly to make things what they ought to be. The group now on duty is the second to be assigned to the planet. 3, the Religious Guardians. These are the angels of the churches, the earnest contenders for that which is and has been. They endeavor to maintain the ideals of that which has survived for the sake of the safe transit of moral values from one epoch to another. They are the checkmates of the angels of progress, all the while seeking to translate from one generation to another the imperishable values of the old and passing forms into the new and therefore less stabilized patterns of thought and conduct. These angels do contend for spiritual forms, but they are not the source of ultra-sectarianism and meaningless controversial divisions of professed religionists. The core now functioning on Urantia is the fifth thus to serve. 4, the Angels of Nation Life. These are the angels of the trumpets, directors of the political performances of Urantia's national life. The group now functioning in the overcontrol of international relations is the fourth core to serve on the planet. It is particularly through the ministry of this seraphic division that the Most Highs rule in the kingdoms of men.
Thank you very much. Charles, I believe you indicated that you were willing to read the next group of paragraphs, starting at paragraph number 5 through paragraph number 12. Would you please go ahead?
Yes, indeed. Number 5, the angels of the races, those who work for the conservation of the evolutionary races of time, regardless of their political entanglements and religious groupings. On Urantia, there are remnants of 9 human races which have commingled and combined the people of modern times. These seraphim are closely associated with the ministry of the race commissioners, and the group now in Urantia is the original core assigned to the planet soon after the day of Pentecost. Number 6, the angels of the future. These are the projection angels who forecast the future age and plan for the realization of the better things of new and advancing dispensation. They are the architects of successive eras. The group now on the planet has thus functioned since the beginning of the current dispensation. Number 7, the angels of enlightenment. Urantia is now receiving the help of the third core of seraphim dedicated to the fostering of planetary education. These angels are occupied with mental and moral training as it concerns individuals, families, groups, schools, communities, nations, and whole races. Number 8, the angels of health. These are the seraphic ministers assigned to the assistance of those mortal agencies dedicated to the promotion of health and the prevention of disease. Present core is the 6th group to serve during this dispensation. 9, the home seraphim. Urantia now enjoys the services of the 5th group of angelic ministers dedicated to the preservation and advancement of the home, the basic institution of human civilization. Number 10, the angels of industry. This seraphic group is concerned with fostering industrial development and improving economic conditions among the Urantia peoples. This core has been 7 times changed since the bestowal of Michael. 11, the angels of diversion. These are the seraphim who foster the values of play, humor, and rest. They ever seek to uplift man's recreational diversions, and thus to promote the more profitable utilization of human leisure. The present core is the 3rd of that order to minister on Urantia. Number 12, the angels of superhuman ministry. These are the angels of the angels, those seraphim who are assigned to the ministry of all other superhuman life on the planet, temporary or permanent. This core has served since the beginning of the current dispensation.
Thank you. The remaining 4 paragraphs of this section describe how the master seraphim operate. Andre, would you be willing to read these paragraphs, please?
Be glad to. Thank you, Neil. When these groups of master seraphim disagree in matters of planetary policy or procedure, their differences are usually composed by the Governor General. But all his rulings are subject to appeal in accordance with the nature and gravity of the issues involved in the disagreement. None of these angelic groups exercise direct or arbitrary control over the domains of their assignment. They cannot fully control the affairs of their respective realms of action, but they can and do so manipulate planetary conditions and so associate circumstances as favorably to influence the spheres of human activity to which they are attached. The master seraphim of planetary supervision utilize many agencies for the prosecution of their missions. They function as ideational clearinghouses, mind focalizers, and project promoters. While unable to inject new and higher conceptions into human minds, They often act to intensify some higher ideal which has already appeared within a human intellect. But aside from these many means of positive action, the Master Seraphim ensure planetary progress against vital jeopardy through the mobilization, training, and maintenance of the Reserve Corps of Destiny. The chief function of these reservists is to ensure against breakdown of evolutionary progress. They are the provisions which the celestial forces have made against surprise. They are the guarantees against disaster.
Thank you very much. For the benefit of the listeners, please let me state that we will now proceed, as I said before, to continue our discussion of the study guide on the work of the Master Seraphim that you could download if you have not done so already from the following website, www.globalendeavor.net. One word, GlobalEndeavor.net. Now, this paper consists of 14 pages. We have worked our way through about half of it. It is divided into three organizational sections: origin, which starts on page 1 and extends to the top of page 3, history since Pentecost, which starts on page 3 and extends to the top of page 8, and the third segment of the paper, destiny during the current millennium. That is where we are now. And we did begin the discussion of question 7 last week, but for the sake of creating a context, I would like to proceed to reread the question as I did last week, and we will resume where we left off in discussion of subparagraph A on page 9. Now, for those of you listening, this will sound like a long speech of mine because the question includes several quotations from the Urantia book. Here we go. Question 7. A mighty messenger states, quote, "On an average world, the post-Adamic dispensation is an age of great invention, energy control, and mechanical development. This is the era of the appearance of multiform manufacture and the control of natural forces. It is the golden age of exploration and the final subduing of the planet. Much of the material progress of a world occurs during this time of the inauguration of the development of the physical sciences, just such an epoch as Urantia is now experiencing. Your world is a full dispensation and more behind the average planetary schedule." End of quotation. A Mighty Messenger, page 593 in the one column edition, paper 52, section 3. Resuming the question, Melchizedek provides a much broader view. In a passage that starts with the phrase mechanical inventions, he highlights material progress on our planet. On the other hand, the Melchizedek makes it clear that science and invention are only one aspect of the myriad challenges confronting the people of Urantia. Therefore, he proceeds to call attention to a wide range of intellectual, economic, social, and religious adjustments that appear to be imminent and urgent. Begin quotation. "Mechanical inventions and the dissemination of knowledge are modifying civilization. Certain economic adjustments and social changes are imperative if cultural disaster is to be avoided. This new and oncoming social order will not settle down complacently for a millennium. The human race must become reconciled to a procession of changes, adjustments, and readjustments. Mankind is on the march toward a new and unrevealed planetary destiny. Religion must become a forceful influence for moral stability and spiritual progression, functioning dynamically in the midst of these ever-changing conditions and never-ending economic adjustments. Urantia society can never hope to settle down as in past ages. The social ship has steamed out of the sheltered bays of established tradition and has begun to cruise upon the high seas of evolutionary destiny. And the soul of man, as never before in the world's history, needs carefully to scrutinize its charts of morality and painstakingly to observe the compass of religious guidance. The paramount mission of religion as a social influence is to stabilize the ideals of mankind during these dangerous times of transition from one phase of civilization to another, from one level of culture to another. Melchizedek, page 1086 in the one-column edition, paper 99, section 1. Resuming the question. In much the same vein, an Archangel of Nebadon comments on the daunting implications for the progressive growth and development of human society, while warning that wisdom, practical experience, and time are essential elements. Begin quotation. Society is not a divine institution. It is a phenomenon of progressive evolution. An advancing civilization is always delayed when its leaders are slow in making those changes in the social organization which are essential to keeping pace with the scientific developments of the age. For all that, things must not be despised just because they are old. Neither should an idea be unconditionally embraced just because it is novel and new. Man should be unafraid to experiment with the mechanisms of society. But always should these adventures in cultural adjustment be controlled by those who are fully conversant with the history of social evolution. And always should these innovators be counseled by the wisdom of those who have had practical experience in the domains of contemplated social or economic experiment. No great social or economic change should be attempted suddenly. Time is essential to all types of human adjustment, physical, social, or economic. Only moral and spiritual adjustments can be made on the spur of the moment, and even these require the passing of time for the full outworking of their material and social repercussions. The ideals of the race are the chief support and assurance during the critical times when civilization is in transit from one level to another. An Archangel, page 911 in the one-column edition, paper 81, section 6. Now we start the first sub-question, sub-question A. How do the Master Seraphim balance the many complex factors that the mighty messenger, the Melchizedek, and the Archangel identified in the three passages excerpted above? Since it is quite reasonable to believe that the various corps of Master Seraphim adopt different approaches to the question of balance, choose two specific corps and describe how their methods may be somewhat different. Now, for the benefit of the listeners who were not listening last week, we had the beginning of a discussion of this subparagraph, and there was a reference to the question of possible controversies or divisions of opinion that might separate the views of one of the seraphic corps from the views of another one. I'm speaking of the Master Seraphim, of course. One comment pertained to the question of whether the work of the Angels of Industry, Group 10, may be somewhat in conflict or somewhat at variance with the work of the Home Seraphim, Seraphic Corps 9. And at least some members of the discussion believed that this would be worthwhile to discuss. I open the floor for anyone who would like to comment on these matters.
Well, I suppose I'll start. Okay,
go ahead, Charles.
I brought up two examples of what I characterize as tension between some of these groups. The Angels of Progress and the Angels of Religion seem to have a certain tension between them. And the Angels of Industry and Home Life may have likewise. And that's based on a few considerations, primarily our own history that shows that these things are often at odds. That is, religion protects moral traditions, generally speaking, organized religion, that is. And progress is forward-moving. Industrialization, is in many respects, for the last approximately 300 years, has been at odds with the needs of the home life. So I put those two groups, but I would highlight this viewpoint. Tension, I understand as, say, variations in task or assignment from the point of view of the angels, the Master Seraphim. Conflict, it doesn't necessarily result in conflict, and there are two points and I'll close with 2 points. One is conflict, I understand, as a failure in communication and a breakdown in trying to find a common ground. The presence of tension doesn't necessarily lead to conflict. And we have some evidence of that, I think, in the text. In the reference we just read to the religious guardians, and I'm opening up my book to that. Number three, the religious guardians. These angels do contend, I'm reading from point three under section six of paper 114, the religious guardians again, number three. These angels do contend for spiritual forms, but they are not the source of ultra-sectarianism and meaningless controversial divisions of professed religionists. That suggests to me that the angels of religion and progress are far more circumspect in how they express their differences. That while there's a natural division between them in terms of task or assignment, they don't. My sense is they don't engage in endless wars of words and feelings.
Mm.
I'll stop there.
Thank you, Charles. Mm-hmm. Who would like to be next?
Well, something occurs to me, and you're with the angels of industry, right? I can see how the angels of industry have a real challenge. And Charles mentioned that, you know, balancing with the home, clearly with health. I mean, industry has wrecked a lot of people's health. And diversion is another one that occurs to me because, just for example, in America, we seem to be over-industrious in a way. We seem to forget. You know, I heard a report recently that more Americans don't take vacation time than any other country on earth. They have the vacation time, but they don't take it. And in a way, we seem to be, from my own point of view, just an overly serious and sober group of folks who just can't seem to relax and enjoy life a little bit. Other countries, especially the older nations, like, for instance, I'll just say the Italians, they seem to be much better at the art of living and just enjoying life than we do. We get overly caught up in our industriousness. So I think the angels of diversion would have a challenge. They're trying to balance then with the angels of industry and, you know, the push forward and the pull back a little bit. I always see it in that term, you know, there's a push forward and a pull back with the balance of these different things. And one other thing occurs to me, and that is about the angels of industry, and one of their problems would be this. The fact that the profit motive is so entrenched right now, and we kind of have a long way to go before we kick in with the service motive, and you know, we know from studying the book that we have to get to that place where the service motive is paramount and not the profit motive. And so I see that as another issue where maybe the angels of progress and religion would be able to help. The angels of the future, even angels of enlightenment, I should say, would deal more with helping us come to a place of service where that's our main motive and not profit so much.
Hmm. Paula, your comments that we in the United States are less addicted to diversion, if I can paraphrase your remarks, than other countries, I think is one viewpoint, but I would point out that sports, for example, are included in the overall view of the angels of diversion, and that sports are extremely prominent in the cultural life of the United States.
So I'm not sure.
I'm not sure I entirely agree with your comment.
Okay. Well, I think of there being quite a few hobbies, extracurricular activities that expand beyond sports, that we as a culture are beginning to become involved in. The profitable leisure, profitable utilization of leisure time is something that you can see beginning to take root in on this
mm-hmm.
world. And, you know, my mom just spent a weekend camping and whitewater rafting with her grandchildren and great-grandchildren and her stepdaughter and partner. And I was just thinking of all of the activities that they crammed into this few days. And it was almost sort of a manic approach
yeah.
to getting as much done as they could during their few days off or the few days they had together.
Hmm.
It was hardly a leisurely experience. And yet...
So-
they
you're
were
saying
able
that
to
Americans
do...
are so disciplined about enjoying themselves that they wear themselves out having fun. Is that it?
Exactly. But, you know, they had to cram all of this fun stuff into, you know, the few days that they had together because they don't have very much time together. And also the kids and grandkids had never really had the experience of being up in the mountains in Colorado before. So there were a lot of things they wanted to do. So they had to do whitewater rafting and horseback riding and hiking and, you know, camping and just all of that all together. And both my mom and the next generation, her daughter-in-law and her partner, came back to saying how exhausted they were, how they really needed a vacation from their vacation before they could get back to work. But the point of this was really that there have begun to be systems in our culture that really encourage people to do fun, enjoyable things in the outdoors where they can really experience the beauties of nature and appreciate some of the things that used to be necessities of the past, the ages past, which are now reflections and recreational. They're sort of like horseback riding, like camping, like being on a wild river. Things that used to be a part of the necessities of life are now recreational. I don't know if that makes much sense, but it's kind of including these links from olden traditions or activities of the ages past that now are part of our recreational leisure time.
That's interesting.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Did you want to elaborate or go in some other direction, Andre? Or
well, I think that's an interesting point, and just taking the 30,000 foot view for a moment, I think all of us in looking at this now and just ruminating, and I'm sure that's true of our listeners right now. You look at the different ways that you could study the interactions of all 12 groups, and clearly the numbers of interactions are quite pronounced just between any two groups, let alone any three or more groups, and the possibilities of the connections and the subtle kinds of reactions and competing objectives or harmonious objectives start to multiply exponentially. It becomes quite an interesting project. Any study group that would want to have a study project on one particular issue and drill down could have fun with this for weeks on end just trying to look specifically at the interactions among each of these 12 core of of Master Seraphim directed core of Seraphim and Reserve Corps. It's just a very interesting study. So a couple of things that jumped out at me in terms of not so much competition but cooperation and the idea that it's been hard to get some groups of humanity interested in the first world with furthering their education formally. And so there have been all kinds of developments along the educational spectrum where one development might dovetail with the angels of diversion in the realm of what people would call edutainment, where there has to be an entertainment component to a person's education in order to engage them. And that would be one aspect, all the way to the other end where institutions like MIT and Stanford and Harvard have invested quite heavily in the internet realm in now providing much of their material, or at least some of their material, in the case of some of these institutions, available free and online for courses to be audited that you wouldn't necessarily get credit for. Some institutions do offer a certain kind of credit for this, but as a way of just bringing up the education of the populace. And this also would indicate on that end of the spectrum sort of a dovetailing of some of the needs of industry with education. Because one of the great problems today is that industry is proceeding so quickly in becoming more and more technical that it is outstripping the ability of education to provide it with truly educated workers. And so you see that kind of thing happening. And I think there's any number of things that could be looked at. One of the curious ones for me would be to get people's ideas of, you know, what on earth would not the angels of superhuman ministry be doing for each other? That mm-hmm. you can at least begin to understand. Well, surely they would need to be helping each other in a certain way. But what would the Associated Reserve Corps, because there is one, associated with all 12 of these Master Seraphim groups, what would the Reserve Corps be able to do in providing a service to the angels of superhuman ministry? That question just fascinates me. And I haven't come up with any kind of settled conclusion. So I'm interested in other people's ideas about that.
Can I make one more observation,
certainly.
Neil?
Yes, please.
You know, it occurs to me that it's really about striking a balance. And obviously, these Master Seraphim, they've got the balance aspect of it down, but we don't. And you mentioned sports, you know, as a diversion, which it is. It's a wonderful diversion, but some people, again, take it too seriously, and it becomes almost like a war, and, you know, more women get beat up on Super Bowl day than any other time, you know, because we go too far with it. We human beings tend to just go overboard with good things. There's a discussion on the board right now between about science and the issues of science, mastering world hunger using genetically modified organisms and the use of chemicals. And again, that's all about balance. That's about us using our abilities to solve our complex problems without going too far, without going overboard. And I think that's their greatest challenge, all of these angels, all of these cores, is to help us strike our balance. And learn that, you know, when to stop, when enough is enough. and or when it's too much.
I agree with you, Charles. I'm going to serve it up to you in just a second about education, but please allow me to give a little bit of an introduction to that. I agree with Paula about not going overboard. When Andre talked about taking a 30,000 feet view, I hoped he was not going overboard from there. But in any case, the observations that Andre made in regard to education serving the purposes of industry are interesting in themselves, but they also raise the philosophic question of what purpose education should serve. And I would point out that the description of the Angels of Enlightenment talks about mental and moral training, whereas earlier Charles referred to religion, organized religion, as having a special concern for moral principles. So it seems to me that there is yet another implicit conflict of interest between yet another group of two core of Master Seraphim. And further, the question of enlightenment in terms of the individual leads to problems of development of character, knowledge, and wisdom over the course of the entire life of the individual, not merely the first two decades. Furthermore, the relationship between enlightenment, or if you prefer, education, and the relationship of and the individual's relationship to productive employment, all of which, it seems to me, involve certain balances and trade-offs. Furthermore, there is the relationship between memorization and encouraging individual thinking and creativity. Charles, I hope I've given you enough to chew on there.
Oh, yes, as has everybody.
Right.
I agree with Paula's original observation and her elaboration concerning the tension that that athletic activities produce. Sports in this society, and apparently a number of others, has a business-like behavior. It's intensely competitive, and it encourages also norms that lead to a compulsion to keep busy. Because if you're in a society like ours, if you're not busy and among many classes of people, then you're not doing something legitimate. The idea of simply sitting still and thinking or reflecting or praying is very strange. It doesn't fit well into this society.
Or
it
even reading.
Even reading. It doesn't fit into, generally speaking, and sports mirrors this. You see it at high school levels. You see it at college levels and in commercial levels, football in particular. There are whole communities that shut down. They shut their businesses down when high school football is played. That's how much they value it. They do this for no other sport. Nothing I'm saying, by the way, is a criticism of any of these activities. That's not my intention. It's only my intention is analysis. Now, to contrast that with what the Arantra book seems to suggest about leisure, the nature of leisure, in a variety of places, leisure is often referred to as rest. These are the words the book uses. Rest, play, freedom from assignment, and those kinds of behaviors. Therein lies a balance. If you have an activity and activity, if you have a job activity that's busied, and you have an off-job activity that's busy, say a sport, there's no balance there. But if you have an activity and rest, there's a balance there. If you have activity and relaxation, I think the word book also uses that word, therein lies a balance. And I think Paula is correct in highlighting that. And Andre's comment with regard to education and leisure, I see education from the book's point of view as something involving study, not rest. When the book talks about study or in-depth study, as it does in a number of places, particularly in the Marantia Life papers, Mansion Worlds and Marantia Life, I think they're talking about education in those terms, that it's logically a result of study. And study should be balanced with play and service and prayer and worship and faith. I think that would honor the book's presentation. And the angels of enlightenment would certainly be appropriate for education. And I'll close with a brief historical summary. There's at least an irony, perhaps a paradox here, but certainly an irony. Up to the early part of the 20th century, the average work week was 6 days in countries like ours. The only day you could have off, talking about majorities now and averages, was Sunday. You didn't have to work on Sunday legitimately because of certain religious needs. But you generally worked 9 to 10 hours a day. That was the norm. I've read men's work diaries. I actually own some. And they talk about how long they worked. 9 to 10 hours a day for 6 days a week, generally speaking. And there was no paid vacation. The idea of a paid vacation didn't materialize in this society, as far as I can determine, until about the 1940s, the 20th century phenomenon. The idea of a paid vacation before that, unless you were into upper levels of management, which most people, of course, were not, you were expected to be paid only for what you did, only for the work that you did. And the idea of a paid vacation, which you can equate with the opportunity for leisure, either how we do it here or how the Urantia book suggests, either way, or education in some fashion, the opportunities for those things weren't available. If you didn't work, you didn't eat. You didn't get paid. And industry, as a result of that, because of industry, people can work far fewer hours and produce more than 100 years previously, 50 or 150 years previously. A farmer once told me you can get more milk out of cows nowadays by modern techniques than his great-grandfather possibly could with cows, given less modern techniques. So this has produced more time, but that shouldn't be confused necessarily with leisure, going back to Paula's original point. Again, the book's point of leisure is quite different than I think is the norm in societies like ours.
Can I share something funny with you guys, something Crystalline said that made me think of a little cartoon that our friend Saskia Ravori created? It's called The Evolution of the Horse. And Crystalline, your comment about what we used to do in the past in ancient times becomes our reversion now, and literally is. Reversion. We're reverting back to a more primitive time when we go camping or when we go on horseback or whatever. And Saskia did this wonderful little cartoon called The Evolution of the Horse. And in the first frame, you see just the horse. And then in the second frame, you see a man on the horse. And then in the third frame, you see a horse actually working for man, pulling a wagon with the man riding, guiding the horse. And then in the fourth frame, you see an SUV pulling a trailer with a horse in it.
Uh-huh.
That is the evolution of the horse.
Well, we've been having a fascinating general discussion, but I'd like to take up the load of the moderator and ask people to focus on an aspect of the question that has not yet been discussed. The question asks people to talk about how the factors that the three authors who were quoted are balanced. And I would specifically ask how the Master Seraphim can work to achieve the idea in the final paragraph of the quotation from the Archangel, wherein he says that always should these adventures and cultural adjustments be controlled by those who are fully conversant with the history of social evolution, and always should these innovators be counseled by the wisdom of those who have had practical experience in the domains of contemplated social or economic experiment. Now, just as a comment of my own, it's clear that what the author, an archangel, is concerned about is the emergence of reforms which are not progressive, which are not really reforms, which are unwise, which ignore the lessons of social evolution. So the question now, again, making it very pointed, is what can the Master Seraphim do to try to bring to bear the wisdom of people with experience as an assistance and a guide to innovators and initiators of new methods?
I think
please,
one of the reasons
please don't all
that
answer
we
at once. Go ahead. I'm
going
to
say I think one of the reasons why this has been a difficult question to answer directly is that we just don't know. I mean, there's a lot of what he's talking about here that I think is a new stimulus of thinking for us. It's really difficult for us to be that far-sighted, to know what the effects of certain changes are going to be and how they might be coordinated by beings or people or personalities with this type of experience. And so I've tended to think of this as being rather in their realm rather than our own. It's pretty difficult for us to see the outcome of even some of our most creative ideas from a long-term perspective. So it seems that this must be something that our angels work with us on in a very careful way, and perhaps by just inspiring ideas that could work, because we don't really have all these answers. I'm thinking in terms of just, for example, in the development of new energy systems, thinking that this might be something that is going to really improve our international access to free or low-cost energy, then finding out that it is utilized for destructive purposes by people in power. Or, you know, like Paula was talking about, the improvement in food production, which ends up causing all kinds of other negative impacts. I think this is a really challenging question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would agree that it's a challenging question. And at the same time, for those of us that have been, you know, given the Urantia book, the fifth epical revelation, what's very interesting is that part three seems to be all about ameliorating that deficit that Neil is pointing out in this study, and that is that, you know, if this is being pointed out by the archangel that, you know, those that are fully aware of the history of social evolution, you know, should have their should be in charge of these kinds of processes. Well, number one, it doesn't seem that we have anybody, unless there are people clandestinely, so, and that would bring up a whole another kind of issue. But there doesn't seem to be any conscious guides to our social evolution, but there don't seem to be any people that are fully conversant with the history of social evolution. And when this was trying to come about, you know, in a period of enlightenment, by the likes of Herbert Spencer and William Graham Sumner at the turn of the 19th through the 20th century, very, very quickly afterward, the idea of being able to think clearly in these terms and scientifically about society fell into disrepute. And
right.
it fell into more a romanticized anthropology, and I mean the likes of Margaret Mead. She did wonderful, excellent work, but it started to become, well, isn't it wonderful all the different, all the relative values that culture present, which is really a wonderful view of culture in many respects. But what it misses is that many of these cultures represent actual stages that all cultures have gone through or are going through. And some have gone through them a long, long time ago. And the authors of the Urantia book take great pains over dozens of papers in Part 3 to point out the arduous history that mankind has gone through in evolving up through primitive man, the efforts and some of the abortive efforts of Revelation to move him along, and still how social and biologic and other kinds of evolution have moved mankind along, and including religious evolution. And I think they're trying to point out to us, those of you that have this book are in position to maybe not immediately become these kinds of leaders, but at least become aware to the extent of promoting the value in society or furthering things along, however they best see this being furthered along, and however we best see this being furthered along. So, in answer to your question, it seems to me that a good deal of creating this leadership is going to be for people to become aware of what the true social and cultural evolution of mankind is.
I totally agree, and I need to just preface what I said by stating that I was trying to look at it from a perspective of people who had not had the benefit of these teachings.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and yeah, I certainly wasn't trying to counter your point of view or anything like that. It's a matter of, it just should be jumping out at Urantia book readers, but these are not necessarily the sexy papers in the Urantia book.
And that, given the information in the Urantia book, they really clearly delineate what is progress and what isn't progress. Whereas in the general culture, there's a lot more confusion about those issues, which you point out by, you know, sort of stating that, you know, progress was being made along those lines, and then it sort of backslid and gained less respect from their respective fields. It's sort of like, it seems like as a planet, we tend to take, you know, two steps forward and one step back all along mm-hmm. the way. Mm-hmm. But because they also, you know, state quite plainly that anything that happens too quickly can be damaging, I think we almost have a tendency then to not move at all.
Right.
We're
very tradition bound.
We all agree that the issue in many dimensions is a matter of balance. Balance of activity as opposed to a balance of tradition. Balance of new ideas as compared with the wisdom of old ideas that have always proved to be wise and helpful. In regard to the question that I asked and that various of you have said is a difficult one, I agree, and I was trying to ask a difficult question. There is one phrase in the middle of the final paragraph from the Archangel that may be a little bit helpful. It is, and always should these innovators be counseled by the wisdom of those who have practiced experience. I would suggest to you that counseled is a very wide word. It doesn't necessarily mean that the people who have wisdom are going to be in charge. So somehow, perhaps, advice and insight needs to proceed from people with experience in these fields to the innovators. And perhaps that is a concept that might lead to a little bit of insight into what the seraphim, the master seraphim, can do.
You know, what struck me when I read that, too, is who is going to be the counselor. And obviously, if we had our normal planetary agencies and material agencies that would be here to help us, so like the Adam and Eve, it wouldn't be such a daunting task. But we really have to cultivate a faith in each other in order to be willing to be counseled by each other. You know, we have this innate distrust of ourselves and our fellows, I think, and I've experienced in my life, that nobody is competent to do the right thing. And, you know, maybe it's because we don't really have an experience of wisdom to that degree. I think that's part of it. I've been blessed to have some amazingly wise people in my life, and I recognize wisdom, but wisdom is not always apparent and not always recognizable to people, and that's a shame. I think if we cultivated a sense of what wisdom looks like, wisdom based on experience, wisdom based on compassion and understanding of human nature, I think so much of wisdom comes from just a basic understanding of human evolution and human nature. Then it might be easier for us to accept wisdom when it's being given.
Well,
we also live in a time, in an era, where we have had less respect for elders than in other times in history.
Good point.
And that might be one way in which we could revert back to some more recent traditions and some traditions that still hold strong sway in other cultures, because here we tend to just disregard the elder to such a great extent, and we don't really value their experience.
I'd like to ask for concluding comments on this segment so that we will be in a position to go on to sub-question B. Does anyone wish to add final comments?
I would actually like to interrupt our answering the question and ask for your opinion on this one, Neil.
I would prefer to wait until we get down to sub-question C, which is largely in relation to the same topic, and then I will answer your request.
And it seems like Charles was wanting to make a comment.
He does talk about this control and so on, and we'll have a greater chance to focus on that one element.
Okay.
Anyone else wish to talk about sub-question A before we go on to sub-question B?
Yes, just a comment on points already made. I always counsel my high school students to put wisdom at the center of their education, to seek wisdom. And I largely defined it for them as the acquirement of insight and foresight. But wisdom has become a casualty of all of the macro, the myriad of macro and micro traumas and tragedies and atrocities of modern history. When the industrial development and the Enlightenment and the democratic movement, beginning in the 18th century particularly, and moving forward into right on down to now, today, commenced. Prior to the First World War, there was in the advancing countries, there was a general assumption, North America, Europe, and to some extent, say in Japan, East Asia, there's a general assumption that progress was inevitable. The traumas, the subsequent traumas on a vast scale, and the shockwaves, moral, psychological, sociological, political shockwaves that they cause, I think has undermined trust, both directly and indirectly. And civilization has to compensate for this now on all levels, from the person to person on up to humanity. And it's struggling to try to understand the problem, and it's struggling to try to address the problem and do something with it. And we originally started talking about balance in response to your elaboration of question A, of how the Seraphim might dissolve some of these tensions. And I thought of possibilities, their guesses. I think it comes, the Seraphim ultimately have to work with what they have, that is, the human beings they have before them. And they have to work with those human beings, the warts and all. So they foster, among other things, other initiatives, they foster human innovations. Remember, the Master Seraphim manipulate planetary conditions, influence spheres of human activity, sift human ideas, focus minds, human minds, and promote projects. So those are their techniques. That's a generalization of their techniques. I was just thinking of an example, apart from the Urantia book, potential Urantia book influence, that's already afoot, already abroad in modern society, which is to try to balance home, emotional, mental health, and industry. There are three core there, three core of the seraphic Master Seraphim. And one of the ideas, a simple enough idea, although maybe complex in working it out, is to foster allowing new fathers to take time off. In other words, you restructure industry in such a way, in business in such a way, the corporate world or the manufacturing world, to allow for that, and yet still allow for productivity, and ditto for the mothers, or possibly to bring their children in to work, to at least discuss those ideas and implement them, and some companies have. And it makes for apparently happier employees and happier employers in the long run, because people then are not just squabbling over money, for example, but they have some real, deep, enduring satisfactions in their lives. In this example, the raising of children, the raising of their children, they give them some relief from the busy tensions and often conflicts of modern society. And that's a possibility, that by fostering human innovations, I'm just using those as examples possibly, that might have approval by the three core that whose domains would seem to be affected by this, they might help on the human level to ease some of the pain and suffering and anxiety, much of its anxiety that results from inconsistencies in society's demands and the individual's demands and wants.
Charles, I'm going to congratulate you on those insights and then move on to the next point. The next sub-question B, reads as follows. In regard to the Master Seraphim in general, or in regard to any specific core that you choose to focus on, what would be the advantages and disadvantages of a comprehensive strategy that would evolve from time to time, as opposed to just formulating a relatively small number of specific goals and objectives, achieving them, and proceeding to identify other targets of opportunity that may have then emerged? So the question has to do with the merit of a basic plan that the Master Seraphim or a specific core would seek to follow, or simply following lines of opportunity that may occur from time to time. I'm asking you to compare the advantages and disadvantages of these two basic approaches.
Well, it seems obvious to me that there must be a long-term strategy. And one of the signposts to that would be in the passage we've read now every time we've begun our study, where it points out that, and we've had this discussion in an earlier program, where clearly there are different groups of Master Seraphim teams under each core at this point. That, in other words, you know, if we're now on the sixth core versus being on the first core, clearly there is a different viewpoint being represented, and even a number of times in some cases with regard to a particular issue like health. Whereas if the same team is functioning, there is a relatively similar point of view that's functioning. But it would indicate that, you know, clearly this is not happening willy-nilly. There are, in my own conception of this, it would have to be that team starts out with a vision and some strategies and tactics, goals and objectives, achieves them, and when they've achieved either the initiation of what they want to initiate or the actual result that they want to achieve, when their particular era is over, they pass it on to the next team that is waiting in the wings to take up the next challenge, which I don't see so much as waiting in the wings as much as I see it being sort of, probably there is a team shadowing the current Master Seraphim team and looking at what it is they're going to have to do and looking carefully at what the team is doing before them without actually participating or interfering in what the team before them is doing.
Andre, if I can try to summarize what I think you have said, and I will ask you to confirm or perhaps revise what I am now going to say, you seem to be saying that you believe there is a general plan that the various corps of Master Seraphim are following, and then they adapt that plan in detail to the opportunities that they see in front of them. Is that a correct idea from what you've said?
Yes, I you know, that's sort of underscored by the fact that, you know, when they give us a paper like Planetary Mortal Epochs, which is a broad brush showing how humanity evolves from a very primitive state, the initiation of mankind as animals with will, you know, the nascent human beings, to creatures of light and life, they're showing in broad brush format seven major epochs and how we get there. And there are clearly many, many minor epochs which are not revealed to us, which now that we've got the idea of major epochs, maybe we can do some of the discovery ourselves and begin to understand our own human evolution and contribute in that way. So, yes, I agree with what you're saying.
Thank you. Are there additional views that others might wish to express?
There are.
Good.
I'll defer to anybody, to Paula or Crystalline, if they wish. Otherwise, I'll go forward.
I think you have the floor.
Okay. I think the most comprehensive strategy, and we should distinguish strategy from tactics. Tactics would be the day-to-day method. Strategy would be the long view, as Andre said, as in our case, or in the Arantxa book's case, would be on page 215. That's in paper 19, section 1, paragraphs 5 and 6, called Spiritual Wisdom. That's your 30,000 feet point of view perspective, Andre. Mm-hmm. Spiritual Wisdom is the book's term, just to remind everyone. I think the Arantxa book is at the core of the strategic vision. And the Arantxa book essentially presents a text that addresses and unifies the age-old problems of understanding facts, meanings, and values, and coordinating them and integrating them, or science, philosophy, and religion, as we might say. And these, when the text serves as a bridge, the text of the Arantxa book serves as a bridge, underlined, highlighted, between modernity and tradition, or to put that another way, between origin, history, and destiny. So So it discerns and unifies and implements. It allows for the discernment, unification, implementation of origin, history, and destiny vis-a-vis what we might, what we understand, the humans understand as modernity, the tension and conflicts between modernity and tradition. And it's this long-term, thousand-plus-year vision of enormous scope and depth, a phenomenal scope and depth, and it's 2,097 pages, that I think offers the world's one of the world's greatest hopes, because, as Bill Sadler Jr. used to point out a number of times, it presents qualities of mind and soul. It addresses mind and spirit. I think he'd refer to it as mind and spirit. We may put in soul there. And it, and by doing both, it enables us to think more clearly, to reason more profoundly, to respect facts. My favorite definition of honesty is, quote, respect for facts, end quote. To do all of that and more, to search for meaning in meanings. And this book, I think, and the Say With Study Groups, in my opinion, offers an ideal opportunity, both from the Master Seraphim's point of view, in my view, and humanity's needs and wants at the same time, to work not only cooperatively but collaboratively, to not only concentrate our energies but to consecrate our energies in this regard. The book is both grand and noble. It has knowledge, but it also has wisdom, and hence it's grand and noble. And I think it gives us a written text, the minimizing distractions and aberrations and distortions and editings and so forth. It allows us the opportunity to have a unified viewpoint. And while it's not perfect in the Avona sense, it is a step toward perfection. And I find the Rancher Book Project to be rational and super rational, to be sane, to be timely, and yet futuristic, all at the same time.
Say, we have a caller.
Perspective.
We have a caller. I'd like to put a caller on if it's acceptable to all of you.
Sure.
Area code 301, you're with us on the Cosmic Citizen.
Well, thanks, Paula. Bob Diebold here again this week.
Oh, hi,
hello,
Bob.
Everybody.
Welcome back.
Hi,
thanks.
Bob.
Sorry I couldn't join you earlier. I traveled this weekend up to New Jersey, so I'm out of my area, so to speak. So I thought I'd just call in, heard some interesting things, and if you give me a second here, I'd like to follow up on a couple of thoughts there.
Okay.
The question B is actually a very interesting one, because it talks about comprehensive strategy versus potentially small goals and objectives. And for someone that's been up at the business level for so long, the typical hierarchy, I don't know if the Master Seraphim had the same hierarchy, but I'll offer what we typically look in business. We start with a vision, develop a mission, produce some goals, get some sub-goals, which we call objectives, and then build our strategies and tactics. Tactics is a trial setter that of the short term, here's the stuff that we do on the ground, and the strategies pretty much develop the way that we go. Well, if in fact that's a model that plays a role, then to look at what kind of an advantage or disadvantage a comprehensive strategy would have, Andre mentioned, I believe it was the health, the Seraphim's health, who had been here, they're in the sixth iteration of the Seraphim that service the health area. We can speculate as to why so many changeovers, but if we look at the wide sweep of history since Pentecost, bubonic plague and all of those sorts of things that devastated the planet for such a long time probably implies to us, I think we can conjecture this fairly reasonably, that these strategies, if they are comprehensive, they do have to change. So the disadvantage of building a strategy based on a set of goals and objectives is excellent. And for these Master Center from who are these grizzled veterans and have been around a long time, they kind of know where we probably should go. You know, how good should health be for us to become spiritually more adept? The disadvantage in a comprehensive strategy would be that we set our goals a little bit too short. So to speculate that there's been six groups, this may be an area, at least on this planet, from the past history that the life carriers write about, that these strategies have to change from time to time, which is really a disadvantage in many ways, because they can't settle on one path at one time. So,
thank you, Bob. I wonder if you think that this might be a contributing factor that could play a role in the decision to rotate personnel of a particular group of Master Seraphim.
Well, that would be my thought, Neil. Last summer, I think Charles was in the workshop where we talked about Master Seraphim, and I think the group spent quite a bit of time. Charles, if you remember that discussion, we looked at the list of turnover and we speculated, and I think that what I'm actually discussing, if I have it right, is some of the ideas that we came up with. This is an area that I doubt if Master Seraphim can get burned out, but they definitely have to work with different kinds of strategies. So particular Seraphim may have had better past history with a particular need that may change over time. For example, AIDS. You know, maybe they didn't anticipate that. And, it's a large enough area that they've got to bring in a group of Seraphim that have had that experience. Obviously, speculation, runs high here.
Well, of course, we're here to speculate. That's the essential reason for this paper. Does anyone else wish to jump in?
Well, I just want to point out that in terms of end results and goals, I think they have ever the goal in mind, and they know exactly what we need, certain milestones we need to achieve. And I think those milestones are really delineated well in the Urantia book. If you look at the Planetary Mortal Epics and other papers like that, really show us the goals and hold up those milestones. And I think they know well where they need us to go. And certainly a revelation, which they also tell us, is indispensable for us to know well where we need to go. We get kind of lost in the mire, bogged down in our own stuff, and we can't see the goal, but they can. And I'm quite certain they have a strategy, and I'm quite certain they know next steps, and much better than we do. I wish we, as certainly education will help to get us to where we know what the next steps are, so that we can start to focus on the goal at hand, the next thing that needs to happen in order to keep progressing in the right direction. We can't. I think one of the things this second paragraph is telling us is that we can't create great social and economic change suddenly. That we have to approach it in a step-by-step way. And I'm certain that they have both. They know what the next steps should be, and they also know what the end result or the great goal is.
I agree with everything you said, Paula. Now I'd like to complicate the question a bit more by pointing out that there are huge variations in the situations in various realms of social and economic development in different parts of the world.
Exactly.
So the Master Seraphim have to have some adjustments in their plans key to the receptivity and situations of different nations and groups and races and so on. So how can they manage to follow a single plan given the diversity of human beings currently living on our planet?
Could I follow that up with a story?
Please.
Of course.
Yes, I think this is a story that probably plays a role here with what Paul brought up, and that is, and with what you're saying about the diversity of things happening on the planet. The I guess everybody knows that the World Health Organization pretty much eradicated smallpox by the 60s.
Mm.
And if you look at the history of how that was done, there were some interesting stories where they started out, I believe in North America, with the gun that was the automatic gun where they would do the injections of the smallpox, and had very, very good success. So as they started moving throughout the rest of the planet, when they got to South America, some areas in South America, and some in Africa, it turned in the other direction, where they actually increased smallpox in that area. Well, what they found out in one location in South America was that the bifurcated needle, which was one of these old primitive things that they used back when they were using horse pox, was very effective in these subtropical areas. And that's the only way that they were able to get rid of smallpox, in those areas. So strategies in those areas were entirely different, but certainly the goal was the same.
Thank you.
And
that's
the angels of the races come into play too. I just want to point that out. I think in terms of the world scene, I think the angels of the races certainly would help with the diversity and the disparaging differences between different cultures, and that may be one of their main jobs. Who knows?
It's certainly a very useful comment. Any further views on the merits of an overarching strategy versus practical goals key to the immediate situation?
Well, a couple of thoughts come to mind. One is that modernity produces mass culture, which has a homogeneous influence in the world. Everything from mimicking and disseminating various forms of art, music, etc., to various thousands upon thousands of products, the way they're used, to medicine, to political, international behavior, particularly diplomatic behavior, there are, and so forth and so on. I would imagine the master, the various seraph and the various corps would work with that influence. And it might have a compensating effect on the differences, the various cultural differences, some quite profound, many quite profound, throughout the world. It is in many ways that one of the major problems of this is the tensions and conflicts between, I mentioned earlier, modernity and tradition. But this does have a homogeneous effect. For instance, to the Japanese, the color white is the most valued, but when they market in blue, because blue is the international color of choice in the 20th century, as a matter of fact, both commercially and politically. And that's just an instance. This runs through horizontally and vertically and diagonally all kinds of behaviors. I wanted to offer something else, though, in an hour or range, and I will endeavor to be brief, Neil. Education has been mentioned as a possible solution, and I support that. In my own teaching, I had an experiment in terms of trying to broaden the imaginations of my students, and I taught many classes this, both in Connecticut and New Mexico, and always had the same result. So there were different classes in different ethnic groups, etc., but they always produced the same conclusion. And the experiment was that what I called an archangel simulation, and that's how I expressed it or phrased it to my students, on the development of atomic weapons. The first atomic bombs were built and used in 1945, but they had their origin in this country in 1939. The Germans began their work on atomic bombs in 1938, at least. The Japanese did also, but they gave it up around 1942. we all know what happened generally in terms of atomic weapons. It produced, it had a direct impact on the nature of the Cold War. So when I taught this from the later 1980s, 1990s, and the first decade of this century, I framed it this way. I would have them read Albert Einstein's letter to President Roosevelt, had them read Harry S. Truman's statement on the atomic bomb, the use of the atomic bomb and atomic energy, et cetera, a number of primary sources that they had to read, and I put it in context, using myself as a secondary source. So I created a simulation in which we all pretended to be archangels. And should we interfere with Einstein's initial letters, in other words, have them not be sent, or interfere with the German project in Czechoslovakia, which had a lot of uranium mines, starting in 1938, to make sure that the atomic bomb would not be developed, given the horror of its use, its tremendous killing. It's a tremendous killing machine on many levels. And the discussions that all these classes had ranged with the idea of interfering with free will. It came down to the, essentially, should free will be interfered with or not? And every class at the end of our discussions, and this simulation ran about a week, all concluded, the vast majority or it was unanimous, either unanimous or the vast majority, 90% plus, concluded that free will, human free will, despite how problematic it is, should never be interfered with. And I use the atomic bomb and the archangel simulation as it were, because we had supernatural power, I told them, to interfere with it or not interfere with it. Curiously, from an educational point of view, they all concluded that we should not interfere. And I think that may be an analogy, possibly a homology, I'm not sure, to what the Master Seraphim do to us and approach us. But even within human education, a curriculum can be devised that would elevate the whole discussion about origin, history, and destiny. And again, interestingly, not a single group ever concluded that human will should be interfered with. I found that fascinating. I'm not sure what it all means, what the full mm-hmm. meaning of that is. But there's something about high school, public high school students, that they all concluded that. And I wonder, again, is it could it possibly be analogous in some way to the Master Seraphim? Just a thought.
That's a fascinating story, Charles. I think if others are willing, it gives me a very good entry point into the third sub-question, sub-question C, which in turn relates to matters that we began discussing before and on which Crystalline asked me to express my own opinion eventually, and I will do that. But may we proceed to sub-question C now?
Sure.
Certainly.
Yes.
Go ahead.
Is it possible to take the comments of one more caller?
I would prefer to do that after we have started the discussion of sub-question C, and then immediately after we start that, Paula, I will turn to you and say, now you may take the other caller if you wish.
Okay. So caller can
Neil,
here with us.
Yes.
And
yes,
Neil,
Andre.
I would prefer to just quickly station identify and let
please.
Everybody know that you're listening to Blog Talk Radio, The Cosmic Citizen, where our show today is the unceasing campaign of the Master Seraphim for Destiny One. We're talking about destiny in the context of Neil Waldrop's marvelous study here, Destiny During the Current Millennium.
Thank you, Andre. I will now proceed to read sub-question C under question 7. This is at the bottom of page 9 for those of you who are reading along with us in the study guide. C, in the third paragraph passage cited above, the Archangel tells us that, quote, adventures and cultural adjustment, unquote, should always, quote, be controlled by those who are fully conversant with the history of social evolution, unquote, and that innovators should, quote, be counseled by the wisdom of those who have had practical experience in the domains of contemplated social or economic experiment, unquote. Do you believe that the influence of the Master Seraphim is sufficiently effective to ensure these outcomes? If so, please explain the factors that lead you to that conclusion. If, on the other hand, you believe that the Master Seraphim can promote these objectives, but cannot be certain that human beings will act accordingly. Please describe methods of theirs that would serve to encourage and foster these personal relationships among human beings. Does one of our current participants wish to comment first, or would you prefer that Paula recognize the new caller?
I urge the latter.
All right, Paula, yeah. I think the consensus is to welcome the additional caller.
Okay. Well, it looks like the caller dropped off. Maybe he didn't.
Well, I hope that wasn't the comment on my reading.
No, maybe when I said hang in there, caller, he went, oh my gosh, I don't really want to be on. He was only holding, but the caller was only holding for 5 minutes, so it wasn't a big deal.
Well, I understand. Now, back to the question, which has to do with applying personal experience to the process of innovation and how the Master Seraphim can seek to achieve that. Who would like to talk first?
Well, I have spoken. Go ahead, Paula, please.
Charles,
no,
you always talk about not interfering with human will, and I think that is an extremely important point. But the other side of it is that there appear to be techniques of the Master Seraphim that do not interfere with human will, but perhaps may serve to stimulate human beings.
You bet.
Would others wish to comment on that?
Well, I think, you know, do I believe that the influence of the Master Seraphim is sufficiently effective to ensure those outcomes? Yes, I do, but with a caveat. I mean, there's nothing that, you know, it's kind of like Jesus saying to his apostles, you know, if this generation rejects the truth that I bring, then another generation will take it forward. And so I think that, you know, the caveat is that they really can't do anything without the help of their material counterpart. You know, without the help of willing human beings who are willing to take up the work and advance it and move it forward, they can't ensure their outcomes at all, at least not in this generation and maybe not in the next generation or for however long humans refuse to take up the work with them. But sooner or later, I think, humans will come around and take up the work, and then it will get done. Then they will achieve their outcomes, and I think they know that. That's why they would never give up.
I'm sorry. If I understood you, Paula, your answer is really in two parts. They may not be able to ensure this in the short run, but you believe they can ensure this in the long run.
Absolutely.
Neil, this is Pat. I'd like to chime in here, if I could.
Please.
I totally agree, Pat. I think that they can hardly tell what we're really going to do. It may take multiple generations before humans actually have the wherewithal. And I suspect by continually working in mind as mind focalizers is one of the ways that they can start to make the influence. You know, we talked about the Fonsberry Swap being something that they may have tried to influence, you know, possibly in Diversion, but they certainly can't tell what we're going to do. And if you think about this experimental planet, it probably adds much more to their strategies, which is why they probably have to change their strategies so often. So, yeah, I definitely agree with that, and it makes their job a little bit difficult. But you said something very interesting that I almost forgot to mention, and that is that if humans are aware somehow that they'd like us to go into a certain direction, that may be the answer to this whole thing here, to really progress society. I'll go back on mute because I'm in the car.
Well, that's very interesting as a question, I would put it, rather than a conclusion. There is a psychology of human beings that is rebellious. In other words, some people, knowing that they're being ordered to do something, will decide to do the opposite. But one can question whether knowledge in an affirmative sense that the Master Seraphim are pursuing a particular goal is or is not constructive, because some people would react positively, whereas others might react in a very stubborn way to oppose it. Next view.
Yeah, one thing that strikes me is that I don't envision this as a very straight line path process, and I'm not suggesting that anybody else here does. But as we reflect on this, given the number of different competing influences and also the number of operating possibilities for cooperation among the various core in various ways, it really seems like this is a very, very complex thing to manage. And it would seem to me that in the same way that there's this wonderful instructive quote that says that, depending on our faithfulness, the presence of God flows, paraphrasing quite loosely here, flows to meet the desire for the presence of God, and to the extent that the collective human will is such that there is less desire for that, it ebbs. And in other words, the will, one aspect of the will of God is that while God never abandons us in any particular sense, there is a healthy respect of the angels and God and everyone for how much we really want to move forward and progress. Mm. And a good deal of life getting us to progress is the fact that life doesn't work so well when it's not progressing. We tend to be dragged, kicking and screaming, into our future very often, because we're so resistant to the positive aspects. In hindsight, we tend to want to look at our history with rose-colored glasses and say, oh, what a good boy am I. But when I look at my own history and I look at how many things I've had to, that I've resisted, getting into, I've made some good choices, but I've made many, many bad choices, I think, throughout life. And those bad choices have been so-called bad choices, let's say counterintuitive learning experiences, have moved me forward in spite of myself at times. And it's still happening now, I'm happy to say.
I was just listening last night to a discussion on the benefits of the Supreme Court decision, Citizens United.
Mm.
In the fact that was the catalyst to a real groundswell of activity within the U.S. culture, U.S. voters, to sort of rally against it. And that it has done more to stimulate people getting re-involved in looking at this, the long-term effects of this type of decision, and than anything else had in like 20 years, including the meltdown on Wall Street. And I thought this was just really fascinating that, we know from many things the Urantia book says that we are by nature sort of complacent and, slow to respond types of beings. Things have to get pretty painful for us to really rally to do something to change the status quo. And I have a feeling that many of the things that we think of as negative stimulus or negative decisions that we've made have long-term benefits. Even to go so far as to use the example of how they describe the Lucifer rebellion, the outcome of not interfering with that, for allowing to let that to run its course, there's been far more good that's come from it than bad.
Yeah.
Crystal, and I agree with you in terms of our inability to predict long-range outcomes from something that happens on a fairly sudden basis. Andre spoke about unfavorable decisions that he'd made in his life, but I think the net point is that all his experiences, positive decisions, negative decisions, pleasant experiences, and unpleasant experiences, led him to the point where he is here today and able to share that wisdom with us. So I would regard that as a positive outcome, and I hope the rest of you agree.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. But I do have a question, though, that I was hoping you would address.
Okay.
And that is that, who do you think those people, as opposed to those angelic core, but who do you think the people are who have the requisite experience in social experimentation, in social progress?
It's a very good question, Crystal, and of course the author, an archangel, is proceeding from his viewpoint, which, to paraphrase an earlier comment of Andre, is at least at 30,000 feet, although we've never been informed as to the relationship between spiritual space and human space. But in any event, I think that reference to requisite experience probably should be interpreted in a very abstract sense. And now perhaps I will succumb to your request that I give my own view. If we go back to the paragraphs that Andre read at the end of section 6 of paper 114, they pertain to the methodology of the Master Seraphim. And I think the key point here is in the third paragraph of the four paragraphs, when it states, when the Chief of Seraphim states that the Master Seraphim, quote, function as ideational clearinghouses, mind focalizers, and project promoters. And then she goes on to say, while unable to inject new and higher conceptions into human minds, they often act to intensify some higher ideal which has already appeared within a human intellect. So now if I draw a general view of what might be happening, there are ideas in any given field of human life in which people are advancing proposals for improvements, or perhaps are commenting on the merit of previous achievements and the need to conserve the values that were already in the circumstances of that field of human life. Typically, a person who is innovative, who is developing a proposal, is looking for information, is trying to act upon insights that he or she may have obtained. So perhaps that person would normally be expected to look around to the writings of other people, perhaps to attend seminars. And in effect, what I'm suggesting, at least as a probable method, the Master Seraphim can seek to heighten receptivity, to heighten awareness of competing ideas and competing values, as expressed by other human beings. And are these the people with the requisite experience? Well, it's hard for me to say that, but at least they have diverse experiences. So if the innovator or the proposed innovator is receptive to other views and is looking around, then perhaps the Master Seraphim can heighten the vividness of certain ideas in that person's mind, and perhaps in the minds of others that he or she might become aware of. And this is the best I can do for an answer. I agree that it falls into the basic concept that Paula expressed before, that the Master Seraphim cannot guarantee the exact results they're seeking in the short run, but that it is very reasonable to believe that they can achieve these results in the long run.
Well, if we were if we were running on the premise that Charles gave to his class, where we as Master Seraphim had unlimited powers and had the ability to, you know, make things happen the way we wanted, who do you think some of those people might be? I mean,
you know,
having a great deal of insight into, like, an entire world full of human beings, who, I mean, if we were to just speculate about maybe some career paths or some professional societies, perhaps, even, where might we find such people?
I can't address that in a sense that will cover the entire range of different disciplines and topics, but if you permit, I would like to go back to the example that Charles gave about the development of nuclear weapons. And I totally agree, personally, with the conclusion that his students reached either unanimously or the level of 90%, I believe I recall Charles saying, not interfering with human will. The other point, though, however, is that it may have been the case that the Master Seraphim who were engaged on this subject stimulated the scientists and inventors working in the project that was jointly sponsored by the United States and Great Britain at the time by heightening their awareness of positive directions for scientific development and diminishing the relative appeal of directions that would not be productive. It may also have been the case that the Master Seraphim, in effect, distracted the German scientists by heightening the attractiveness of methods that the Master Seraphim knew would not work, and therefore distracting the German scientists by implication into directions that would not lead them to develop an atomic weapon. But I tell you here, everything I have just said is speculative. It does not involve interfering with human will, but it does predicate their possibility of heightening receptivity to particular ideas and concepts that are already circulating.
I've got a thought on that also, if I could interject a little bit here.
Sure, you have the floor.
If there's any background noise, just somebody say so. I am driving in the car at the moment. I wanted to respond a little with Crystalline's thought, and then to say first, Neil, that I think it's very instructive to pull from history, to speculate from history, I think, to be able to look at, is there anything today that we could address that would point to the fact that there is that there are concepts that potentially the Master Seraphim may be trying to highlight? And just to take two simple examples out of the Urantia papers, personality and the agitated mind spirits, while we can possibly think that it might be pure revelation, my thinking is that those two thoughts have already occurred in humans, which really then allow the revelators to put them into the papers. If that's the case, then it would be instructive and possibly supportive to find those scientists or those biologists or those archaeologists who have somehow stepped onto those two concepts in a much different fashion, maybe just a pure scientific fashion. So I think that there are people today who are starting to tap into this concept that the Seraphim, I would think, would be highlighting, mind focalizing, I should say, that those two particular concepts. I'll go back on mute.
Thank you. I agree that these are certainly interesting speculations, and they are very responsible ones as well. Would others like to interject their own views on this point?
I would.
Sure. Yeah, I might just remind us that we're at 5 minutes left in our regular broadcast.
Thank you. Do you wish to comment, Andre, or were you going to yield to Charles?
I'm going to yield to Charles very quickly, but I want to just say quickly that, you know, we could all come up with individuals that strike us as interesting. I once saw an interview with Lee Kuan Yew, the former president of Singapore, and I would suggest that there are people like that that might be good bright lights with regard to knowledge of social evolution. But I yield to Charles.
Well, they've always been worthy individuals. That's our own history provides lessons concerning that. The problem is that mortals lack the ability to identify them until after the fact, with hindsight.
Right.
And I'm addressing Crystalline's question. However, the Master Seraphim could use foresight by identifying them using supermaterial means on a natural process. And there are reasons for this. In our own history, using hindsight to elaborate or illuminate, rather, foresight, in our own history, many of these persons were not of any establishment, Jesus included. They had nothing to do with an establishment of any kind, or they were rejected by it, even. Or they were at the margins of an establishment of some kind. It doesn't matter if it's religious, political, scientific, economic, moral, social, so forth. And the third category, the reason we can't identify them except by hindsight, the reason we do not identify them except by hindsight is these individuals often created brand new industries, organizations, movements, inventions, etc. And we simply don't have the means to do that. Societies are organized institutionally, and institutions establish the norms and roles and status relationships to guide them as to who will be selected for leadership, when the problem is much deeper and more complicated. True leaders, for the reasons I've given, are often outside that process. And I don't know how mortals can compensate for that. I can't imagine how Master Seraphim could go forward and identify such people and then foster them. But these are the reasons, one or more of these reasons that I've given, that oftentimes the true leaders often come from unlikely backgrounds. It's unlikely because conventional institutions that are established don't think imaginatively they have many prejudices and biases.
Right.
And they tend to suppress or ignore or reject.
Or follow along in the same stream of conventional thinking.
Yes. Just to give one example, it's a military example. General Billy Mitchell in 1927 demonstrated that air power could sink warships. That was a very novel idea and quite radical. He was essentially court-martialed and drummed out of the military service because it was too radical. And on December 7th, 1941, we found out, as a matter of fact, he was correct in 1927. And that's just typical of much of human history. Andre talked about real sociology on government neighboring planet. We will need far deeper and more sophisticated methods to and be free of our biases and prejudices and our animal legacy first before we can do what you're suggesting, what you're asking about, Crystalline, seems to me. I think the problem is that great.
I would like to follow Charles's point in, again, reaching back to Crystalline's question. The identification of people who really do have the knowledge or the wisdom is undoubtedly more a possibility that the Master Seraphim can achieve than we can. And I think the point about not necessarily being prominent in human life and not necessarily affiliated with organized institutions that are prominent is very important. That creative thinking of an innovative character very seldom comes from entrenched, established institutions. In the field of business, most businesses that are profitable do not want much to change. They want people to keep buying their products as before. I wonder now, Paula, if we might be close to having to
say that we are.
We
have less than a minute.
Okay.
We're at about 20 seconds.
This
so
is
we
Neil
got through
Waldrop.
One section?
We did.
Go ahead.
I think we finished the three sub questions of question 7, and we will start on question 8 at the top of page 10 of the study guide next week. We have been discussing the study guide on the work of the Master Seraphim that I prepared. For those who are listening and who may have joined us later than the beginning, you may download this study guide from the following website, www.globalendeavor.net, Global Endeavor, one word, GlobalEndeavor.net. The link to download it is near the bottom of the home page. We hope you will join us again next week when we will continue this discussion, which I have found extremely interesting today.
Me too. And thank
you
all so much for joining us and for adding your wonderful thoughts and ideas and speculations to this great study. And thank you, Neil, for creating it for us and leading us through this. It's been a wonderful endeavor.
Yes, truly fine paper. I won't be able to join you next Saturday, as I said, just to remind you. I'll be on the road.
Thanks for having me, everybody. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Bob.
Thank you, Bob.
Bye, Bob.
Maybe
nice
the
to have you back.
Can tune into your insights, Charles.
Which you always do.
Maybe.
All right.
Let me ask you a question. That's the 29th. No, would you be discussing this paper on the 29th, Saturday, June 29th?
I think that's the last day we have planned for this series.
Okay.
So hopefully we will be discussing it then.
I'll do my best to join. I'll be in Connecticut, but I'll try to put aside some time.
Because I know, Neil, you had said starting the beginning of July you weren't going to be available.
I was going to have to miss 1 week, just as Charles has said that he will have to miss 1 week. But I would be available on the second weekend of July if we are still not quite finished with this.
All right. I'll see if I can keep that open in the scheduling then.
But it's possible that we will finish in two more sessions, although the very interesting discussions that we've been having during the last few broadcasts make me doubt that we will finish in two more.
Well, I suspect we may end up coming up with an addendum to the study because it's raising so many other questions for all of us.
But I think we will have to take a break because we have a couple of other guest speakers that we've been postponing for a while. So hopefully maybe we can take a break and come back to it.
Yeah.
Let's plan to at least get through 10.
Your disposition again for the next 2 weeks and for the second Saturday in July and following.
All right. Okay. Great.
Yeah, and we'll need to talk about that second Saturday as well because that's the summer study session. So we'll be talking about all of that, I guess.
I believe that we're all flexible and we're able to work out these matters.
Right.
Yes.
The group will be guaranteed of success in the long run, although we can't guarantee success in the short run.
True that.
Well, Paula, you gave us a good formula. I probably will use it to that.
Okay.
We'll shoot to get through 10 then. All right.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Well, much love. Have a wonderful week, my friends. And until next
time. Yes, you too. To be continued next week.
I love to all of you.
Yes,
much
thank you, Charles,
you
and thank you, Neil. Wonderful.
We'll miss you next
and
week,
and thank
Charles.
You to all of our Master Seraphim.
Yes.
Yes, indeed.
Bless
for
you,
all
indeed.
Their
heart.
Unceasing labors.
God bless them.
Yeah.
God bless us, everyone.
Yes.
Yeah.
And until
bye-bye.
Next time. Bye for now.
Bye now. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Adios.
Thank you.
You've been listening to The Cosmic Citizen, a radio program focused primarily on the study and discussion of the Urantia Book and its teachings. The Urantia Book is a religious text that claims to be written by angels and other superhuman personalities. If you are a Urantia Book reader or a spiritual seeker looking for new truth, we hope and pray you have been nourished and edified by our ministry. Please remember that the views expressed on this program do not reflect the official views and opinions of any Urantia organizations. There is no official interpretation of the Urantia Book. So all opinions expressed on this program exclusively reflect the personal biases of the hosts, guests, and callers who participate in these discussions. And remember, only a brave person is willing honestly to admit and fearlessly to face what a sincere and logical mind discovers.